satellites from Launch Complex 39C. There is a 39A and 39B are the big ones, but there's a 39C that was really never used, that was planned back in the Apollo days. But they're going to release that one, and Firefly plans on using another kind of rocket called the Aerospike. Completely different design. 10 engines surrounding the spike thing in the middle. And it's supposed to be more efficient for launching through the atmosphere. So you could look for that probably launching maybe 4 years from now, the earliest I would think, 4 or 5 years from now. A lot of American companies involved. A lot of things going on. Paragon, you got Paragon. They're going to be launching balloons with people in it all the way up to the stratosphere, 50,000, probably, what is it, it's got how high, a couple hundred thousand feet up. Let me drop it. Coming back on parasails, you got people that have already paid, put their money down for that. You've got Virgin Galactic, they're now testing their new Spaceship 2. The original Spaceship 2 crashed in 2014. You know, unfortunately, killed one of the pilots. But now they've got a rebuilt one. It's supposed to be better and new and improved. And they've taken that on a carry flight. They call it a carry flight up to 50,000 feet. They just did that last week. They carry it on the White Knight. White Knight has four jet engines, and they carried all the way up, and then they came back and landed on the runway, and I'm expecting them to start testing probably within a year, maybe less than a year. They're going to probably do, they'll start dropping the spacecraft with a crew on board, lighting off their engine and seeing how they do. A lot of private companies, a lot of countries involved. There's a lot of launch complexes all over the world. If you ever look at a map, it's unbelievable. Back to you there.
In the case of the attempted lunar landing by the Soviet Union, Russia, around the same time we were doing it in the late 60s, their biggest booster, because they didn't have a large enough engine like our Saturn V engine, they were using, I think, 32 individual engines. And the piping to do all that and to keep it stable gave them a lot of grief. Now you're telling me that India uses a solid rocket core with a bunch of liquid rocket boosters around the perimeter, if I understand correctly. Does each individual booster have its own oxidizer and fuel? I'm having trouble believing you've got piping around the perimeter outside of the solid rocket core that runs all these liquid rocket boosters on the outside. How many boosters, and how do they feed fuel to all of those, Paul? That sounds like a very unusual way of doing things. But from what you're saying, it's apparently successful. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I don't think they're running regular kerosene. I think they're using hydrazine, which mixed with nitrogen tetroxide, is instantly ignites the engines. I think they're using that. I'll have to check on that. I mean, that's what everybody uses for thrusters in space, because they're long lasting. You could spend, you know, over 200 days in space with those things, and they keep on functioning. Even beyond that, but that's their human-related lifetime, I think 260 days or something. That's why the Soyuz, the manned Soyuz craft go up to the space station. They can only last roughly 6 months, and then they bring them back. That's how come when Scott Kelly and his partner from Russia, they went up. They came back on a different spacecraft. Well, nowadays when you go up, you come back on the same spacecraft. launch is delayed with Sean Kimbrough. He's the American. And he's got a... His crew is now a little delayed because they found a short circuit in the new Soyuz spacecraft that was developed. This is actually the second flight. The first one went up successfully. Actually, that one was a little delayed a little bit, but for a different reason. So that's supposed to be going up within a couple of days, but that looks like that won't go up until...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Coming back with the lady doctor from Connecticut, Ruben, Kate Ruben. They'll be coming back October 30th. Might as well give you the updates on all of that as well. But, the Soviets were going to do it. They had the N-1 rocket. And they tried launching that three different times, and every time it got off the launch pad, it didn't get far and blew up. All the piping and everything, it was too complicated. And those engines, that design of those engines, they kept them, and they were called NK-33s. And we had a company in America buy them up called Aerojet Rocketdyne. They bought up a lot of NK-33s from the, I guess, from the 60s or 70s. And then they reworked them here and started putting, had a contract with Orbital Science, now it's called Orbital ATK. And they started putting them on the Antares rockets, sending their supplies via the Cygnus spacecraft up to the International Space Station. Worked out the first couple of flights, third flight, and that thing blew up. And now they're not allowed to use the NK-33s. Not that they're allowed, since they had a problem with it. Orbital dropped them. And now they have new ones. Let me drop it. Called the RD-181. I think that's the number. So they had to replace them. And which is kind of weird. They're more Russian rockets, but they're going to use two of them on every flight. The good news is it's going to put out more horsepower than, more thrust than the previous one, so they were able to send up their bigger Cygnus enhanced spacecraft with more cargo and more space to the space station. And that flight should be coming up in October as well, taking off from Wallops Island, Virginia, not too far from here. Back to you, Dick.
One more time, Paul, I missed it. That is, in the Indian rocket that has a solid core and liquid boosters, I presume there's a number of liquid boosters around the perimeter of the rocket, and maybe they drop away. How many of those liquid boosters, and does each one of them have their own individual fuel and oxidizer supply? How in the world do they do that, Paul? That sounds like a complicated way of doing it. Maybe I'm misunderstanding. K2LIW.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not even sure of the fuel. I'm taking a guess with that one. But yeah, I do know it's a liquid fuel boost is solid core. And then the second stage, by the way, is they go back to liquid again. So that's it's complicated. I like what the American companies are doing. You know, they keep almost the same fuel for every stage, you know, for the first and second stage anyway. That's what we've been doing with SpaceX and with Blue Origin. And that's a good design. They have all these different complicated designs. I mean, yeah, well, actually, the Atlas V has a complicated system too, but you know, they have liquid design for the first stage. That's RP-1 and liquid oxygen. And then they have solid boosters, anywhere between 1 or 5 solid boosters. But their upper stage is usually the Centaur liquid-fueled hydrogen / oxygen. So everybody has their different choices. I'll have to read more about the India. I don't know the layout. I think it's a fuel that's when it's mixed with nitrogen tetroxide, which I think is really like laughing gas. It ignites on contact. I believe that's the type they're using. But I'll have to check on it. I'll have to look into that. Back to you there.
Yeah, when it comes to armed rockets, where our major boosters are liquid, I mean, our major core is liquid rockets, great big humongous ones, with some solid boosters around the perimeter. And we steer the rocket, the whole spacecraft, by way of gimballing those engines, which is a little bit complicated. I see one slight advantage of the Indian approach. A solid core gives you the majority of the thrust. The nice thing about liquid rocket engines is that you can throttle them. Maybe it's not easy, but you can make them thrust go up or down. Therefore, if the liquid is the perimeter rockets, and you can decide which ones are giving full thrust and partial thrust without gimballing, you can do steering with that. You can't throttle a solid rocket booster. You turn it on, and it's going to burn come hell or high water. You can't even turn it off, so to speak. So liquid is throttleable. So I can see one advantage of them doing it that way. Now, one other thing I wanted to ask about, the thrusters that you've described, which I think usually have hypergolic fuels, hydrazine and nitrous oxide or whatever. In other words, these two fuels, you mix them together, they explode on contact, they give you thrust, and thrusters are built with something like that. And so you said that these thrusters are good for 270 days. Okay. The thrusters that are on Voyager have been out there now for 38 years. And they still are doing a beautiful job of keeping that 12-foot dish aimed to the nearest tenth of a degree aimed at Earth. Otherwise, you're not going to talk to Voyager at 12 billion miles. What in the world are those thrusters? 38 years downrange. How do they still have fuel? How do they still have reliability? How do they keep working that downrange? Can you imagine storing compressed fluid in a tank for 38 years without it leaking away? Every one of those valves has to open up and close with absolutely no leakage. I mean, the tiniest leak in the world, after 38 years, you got nothing left. How in the world did Voyager do that? WS2N, K2RIW, hey, Paul.
Yeah, I guess there's a difference between man-rated and satellites. You know, we have satellites that are operating on, you know, 2 to 6 satellites on a regular basis. They go up all the time. They're 15-year lifetime. But I'm just talking about the man-rated ones. You know, they worry about the fuel, you know, causing leaks in the whole system. You know, it tends to get to the whatever they use, metal or whatever the tanks are. So that's what I've read about. The Russians have still plans of putting up another module to the International Space Station. And it was designed and completed back in 2007. So here we are all these years later. And they have fuel in the lines, and because it got to its 10-year limit of where, you know, even though there weren't any leaks, they decided to rebuild this whole thing. So it was, you know, scratched the engine, pulled all the piping, pulled, and the thing never module that's supposed to be attached to the space station. So, that was a 10-year deal. Let me drop it. You know, after 10 years, they scratched it. They scrapped it because it reached its expiration date. They don't want to send something up, you know, that had fuel in it all those years later. So now that's all been rebuilt, and they still plan on launching this module. It's another laboratory. It's got a bathroom on board. You know, it's got all kinds of thrusters. It's going to be able to push the space station. They need something eventually to replace the ZESA. ZESA is the original module. Not to replace, you know, they're not going to replace that module, but they need something to do the work that was doing, because all that piping and everything is all getting old, you know. That went up in 1999. That was first launched. Here we are 17 years later. Back to you, Dick.
How many astronauts are on the International Space Station right now, Paul? I think three of them came down in the Soyuz a week or two ago. I think we had... How many are on the International Space Station? Americans and Soviets. And how soon are we going to be sending up some more? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Right now there's three. And a week and a half ago there was six. But those three came back. One of them was Jeff Williams. He's the American counterpart. And he's got a collective hours of over 500 hours. So he's got the record now. Collective. Not one shot. But he's had five different flights. And now you have three on board. The American that's on board is Kate Rubin, and she's been up there almost 5 months, and she'll be coming back at the end of October 30th. But before she comes back with her crew, another crew will be going up, and that's the one that was delayed. And I tend to remember the American names, and that's Sean Kimball. He'll be going up. He was actually supposed to go up this week, but that flight was delayed. They found a short circuit in the new MSO-2 Soyuz spacecraft. So Kate Rubin went up in the MS-01. And the reason it's starting with 01, 02 is because this is the third iteration of that spacecraft since the beginning of the International Space Station. So they're upgraded Soyuz. They look the same. They have different antennas and different things. Added propulsion, more thrusters, things like that. So that'll be going up probably the beginning of October. We drop it. So then you'll have six people on board. And then you'll have three after the October flight when they come back. And then there's another flight plan. You know, it just goes around like that, and then you eventually be back up to six. And most of the times it's six. Usually for a short period of time it's just three. You might remember when the space station started out, they had two, and then they got up to three. And then we had 2003 with the Columbia disaster, and then they brought that back down to two. They were worried about supplies. And then as the space station got completed, you had another bathroom, and you had all the trusses built, and the solar arrays all put up. You had that capability. They upgraded it to six. Plan is eventually get to seven. That will happen probably around two and a half years from now once you got the private flights going up. Either by SpaceX or Boeing. Boeing is developing their own spaceship too, and that's called Starliner. Starliner will also be able to carry a crew of four up to the space station, just like SpaceX will be done with their Dragon crewed vehicle. Once that gets developed, they should start docking with the space station. They'll have a steady line of 7 people on board. But if the Russians have their way and they have their problems, they can't get this other module I was talking about ever launched. They plan on eventually cutting back from 3 in their end down to 2. So then we'll be back to 6 again, which I hope that don't happen. So this is a lot of science that's going to be developed. Right now you have around 40, 45 hours of science coming back from the space station per week. With an extra person on board, you'll be able to double that to around 80 hours per week of science. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2M.
K2RAW testing on 9125. How about that? I come through with a lot of extra delay, but over the whistle, but it comes through. The total number of countries that have something to do with space, the total number of companies that have something to do with space, the total number of spacecraft, the total number of payloads, total number of boosters, first, second, third stage boosters, payloads, total number of astronauts, cosmonauts, and whatever. As I hear you quoting all these things, Paul, I'm overwhelmed. How the hell do you keep all of that straight? It's going to sound like an insult, but I'm going to tell you, you're mildly obsessed with space. It must be for a good fraction of your lifetime to absorb and remember all of that. I have trouble remembering the name of somebody who was my roommate at the last company I worked with, and he was a roommate for a couple of years. I have trouble remembering his name. And you've got all of these countries, all of these companies, all of these boosters, all of these spacecraft, all of these astronauts, cosmonauts. Wow. I'm impressed. But with that knowledge, and pat yourself on the back, how many countries are involved in space right now? We certainly know about United States, Russia, China. You told us tonight New Zealand. That's a brand new one on me. I presume France has done some work. I presume England has done some work. I presume Germany has done some work. Name the countries that have really launched something into space on their own with their own boosters. Obviously, a lot of countries have built payloads that somebody else launches for them. But how many countries really have their own booster and space launch pad? Give me a quick list of those, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
Okay, very, very good thing. Well, I used to naturally get a lot of magazines and newspapers before the internet and books from the library, buying books, you know how it goes. But now, of course, we have the internet, and probably the best websites I go to, of course, is NASA, space.com, although they tend to, space.com is a little flamboyant, you know, they'll talk about Star Trek or something, you know, I don't care about that, but they have a lot of good information. But then the ones I really like are Space Flight Insider. Space News is fantastic. Space Flight, there's a spaceflight.com, which does an excellent job. Another excellent one is Space Flight 101 and Space Flight Now. Then there's another one that you go to for all the flights that are going off worldwide. And we go around and around just on those, really like eight websites. You know, you could follow pretty much all of this. And I don't like to get on and talk about one unless it looks like two of them are talking about it, but one's talking about it. It might be hyped up and, you know, might not be be that reliable. The information might not be right. Let me drop it. Let's say two of them or three or more, you know, they're all talking about the same thing, then you're good to go. And the Deep Space Network, which you go to, you can look at all the conversations that are going on between the robotic spacecraft that are out there and the Deep Space Network. But you look at those abbreviations, and then you say, oh, I wonder what the, Mars Global Surveyor is doing, or the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, or the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. You know, you see the abbreviations, and you click on it, and you realize what spacecraft you're looking at. And then you can go back and read about them, when their launch was, and how they're doing, and if it's still operating. Rosetta, for instance, is closing down. I think I mentioned that last week. That's going to land back on Comet 67P, and we won't hear from that anymore after the end of September. And that's pretty much the way it goes. Now, the amount of countries, well, let me think. I could put a mark down for every country there is, but let me drop it. Japan launches rockets on a regular basis. In fact, they launch the HTV up to the International Space Station once a year, and they bring at least 10,000 pound supply up. So we'll check off Japan, China, Russia. Israel just launched a rocket there about a week or so ago from their from their location, and they have to launch due west. They can't go east, otherwise the Arab countries aren't going to be happy with them. So they launch west, and they actually have retrograde orbits. And New Zealand, well, New Zealand isn't, they themselves are not launching the rockets, but this company called Rocket Lab that I just mentioned before has built a launch complex down there, so they'll be launching rockets. Let me drop it. And when I mention China's got like four different launch complexes around the country. Gobi Desert, and then they got them up north. And, the United States, of course, we have launch complex on the East Coast and the West Coast, Florida and Vandenberg Air Force Base. And then north, we have Kodiak Island, which has just come back to life. They had to do a rebuild of their launch complex a few years ago. Of course, that's part of the United States. We have launch complexes in New Mexico. You have Blue Origin launching from there, doing their test work. Eventually, they're going to put people out there. You have SpaceX now building a brand new launch complex in Chica Boca, I think they call it that. It's near Brownsville, Texas. Boca Chica. But they're building for the last, I don't know how many years, they're building down there. They plan on launching the Falcon 9 from there. India, of course, they have quite a few launch complexes. We have the Sea Launch, but that hasn't, they haven't used a launch from there in quite a while. That was a consortium of different countries using a Sea Launch. They would go out to the equator and launch from there. They put a whole bunch of satellites into orbit. Let's see. I know we're missing a few countries. Sorry for leaving them out. Back to you there.
Israel's a brand new one to me. Launching to the west. I mean, the rotation of the Earth at Israel's latitude is around 900 miles an hour, so you have to fight the 900 miles an hour that you're moving to the east and put on another 900 miles an hour just to equal. I mean, you take an 1,800 mile an hour hit to launch to the west as opposed to launching to the east. That's quite a disadvantage. Oh, amazing. Now, I didn't hear you mention Germany or France or England. They can use other people. France, I guess, is involved with Kourou in South America. I think that's a French mentioned France. I don't know if the United Kingdom has anything. And I don't know if Germany has anything. So among the developed nations, right now, they seem not to be mentioned, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, I left European Space Agency out, which is a consortium of, 19 countries, I think it is. And they all collectively pay for launches from French Guiana in Kourou down in South America. So they have quite a few launches there. They have a larger rocket, medium and low, so they cover all three bases. European Space Agency, they launch their big rocket, the Ariane 5, from there. And by the way, that's the same rocket that will be launching the James Webb Space Telescope in 2 years, the Ariane 5. Then you have the Soyuz, sounds Russian, because they actually bought the Soyuz rocket, the whole rocket, and they bring them down to French Guiana. So, you know, some people buy the engines, like I mentioned before, the NK-33s Aerojet bought for the Antares rockets. Well, European Space Agency bought whole Soyuz rockets from the Russians, and they completely rebuild them. You know, they reconfigure them to their purposes, and that. They consider that a medium launch capability. See, every country would like to have heavy, medium, and then they have the low grade rockets, which in their case is being built by Italy, and that's called the Vega rocket. Vega has launched 6 times so far, and one of the
repeater timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The L1 position. So they have a, you know, even though it's considered a smaller rocket, the payload wasn't that much, and they put it out in the L1 position between the Earth and the Sun. And that's doing that research with the gravity waves. So yeah, you got the European Space Agency. So those countries themselves, as far as I know, don't have any launch pads. But collectively, they're using the South America. Let me drop it. Now, Brazil had one. They were building one, and they were going to start launching from Brazil. Unfortunately, they had a big explosion about, it was 3 or 4 years ago, probably about 4 years ago, and it killed 21 people on the launch facility. They had a solid rocket booster go off. So that knocked them out of business, and I guess they don't have the funds to rebuild. I haven't heard anything about that. So, there's quite a bit around, Dick. you have Spaceport America, that's down in New Mexico. And I think there's only one small company launching out of that. And their goal was to eventually have a whole bunch of companies come to them. The state of Mexico paid a lot of tax money to build this place. I think it's I don't know if they're doing anything with it lately. Virgin Galactic wanted to fly out of there. I guess with their delays, that might not happen. Maybe eventually, a couple of years from now. Back to you there.
How amazing. Rather than list all the countries that are either in a consortium or doing individual launches of the developed nations, let's do it the other way around. Rather than list the ones that are doing something, let's list the ones that are not doing something. Is Scandinavia involved? I'm pretty sure the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, Turkey, I'd like to believe they're not involved yet. But is Scandinavia involved in the European Space Agency? Norway, Sweden, Denmark? So, if we do it the other way around, of the developed that in?
Yeah, well, Norway has some kind of a launch facility, but they've been using it for balloons. In fact, NASA just, I think they launched their final balloon there recently. And they were doing tests with the magnetic field. You might remember the, I think it was called the MMS mission that went up with an Atlas V rocket a couple of years ago. And they sent up four satellites orbiting the Earth and quite high altitude. And they went at the same time, and they're near one another, like, you know, within a couple hundred miles of one another, and checking out the magnetic fields. So, you know, that's still in operation. So NASA wanted to do stratosphere testing of the magnetic field at the same time with the satellites that are going in, you know, that are in orbit. So they've been launching balloons from a complex in Norway. But, Norway and Denmark, they're all part of the European Space Agency. They're involved with the International Space Station. I believe there's 20 countries involved with the, collectively for the whole International Space Station. So they've had their own astronauts about 2 years ago. They had the first astronaut from Denmark. We've had many astronauts from Canada go up. Canada's involved with, they're always supplying the robotic arms they did for the space shuttle, they did for the International Space Station. They have that big robotic thing called Dexter. Dexter is attached to the space station as well. So that's...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
No, that's the goal. You know, Poland has sent people. Italy has sent their astronaut. Samantha Christopher Eddy was up there. She did a great job for Italy. I don't know, it goes on and on. And there's plenty of people that I'm mentioning, by the way, including Samantha. They all had ham radio licenses and have done good work by contacting schools on Earth. Back to you, Dick.
In order to be a effective and respected electronic engineer, for instance, you have to actively do something to stay current, particularly if you're in RF engineering, as I was for a whole lot of years, and maybe still am. You've got to be reading a bunch of journals, subscribing to things like IEEE antennas and propagation, microwave theory and techniques, electronic design news, electronics magazine in the old days, and so on. You got to spend a certain number of hours per week reading, talking, going to conferences, in order to stay current. There's always brand new antennas and transistors and power supply. All kinds of things are being, created, invented all the time. You have a huge interest in space, I sense, Paul. Let me drop this. It's only obvious by what we hear you say to us on each one of the space reports that you're actively doing something to stay current. Those eight major websites that you go to, and magazines that you read, and so on. If I had to make a rough guess, over the last year, for instance, are you averaging 10 hours a week reading, studying, doing whatever to stay current, to keep track of all of these people, countries, companies, spacecraft, space payloads, and so on? Are you spending 10 hours a week, do you think, Paul, rough guess? Or is it more than that? WS2N, K2LIW?
Oh, I'll say 3 hours a day. So, I'll say 21 hours. This weekend's the same thing as Monday as far as I'm concerned. So, you're looking at 21 hours a day, a week, I guess. Longer if there's a launch, you know, I'll sit and watch this stuff for hours on end, you know, and sometimes there's a delay, not a scrub, but a delay, so that, you know, that'll give you a couple more hours. And you end of the day, there's a lot of time involved, you know. And then you put that together with all the, you know, the past that I've had by working in a lot of these places, Brookhaven Labs and Grumman, and, you know, I never made it to your place, AIL, but I know some people that did. And even so, you know, we're doing heating and air conditioning and fire prevention systems in these buildings. You know, you get to be around some of these people. Brookhaven Lab was great. The scientists would give you information. You'd ask them questions, and they'd start telling you what they're doing. They were great. Back to you, Dick.
3 hours a day is 1,095 hours per year. I mean, there are people who think I put in a lot of time running 4 hours per weekend on the TechNet. That's only 208 hours per year. You're putting in 1,095 hours per year. Wow. That is dedication, Nicole. You have found a passion, a purpose. Do you know, are you able to find anyone else who has your degree of interest in space? Who are you able to interface with where you trade war stories? You trade information with? I suspect on Long Island, you're kind of alone. I mean, let me drop. I mean, the Star Trek enthusiasts, they've got tricky conferences, Lunacons, and things like that. For your particular passion, ham radio has all kinds of get-togethers. But when it comes to people who study space very actively, who else can you interface with that even comes close to being able to compare things with you, Paul? I think you're a little bit alone on this one. WS2N, K2RIW, you're just a little bit unusual.
Yeah, I can't go by my family because, you know, I brainwashed them with all of this stuff, so, you know, they know pretty much a lot of stuff about it, you know. They're not going to memorize it, but they'll know what I'm talking about if I say that Falcon 9 is going up, or, you know, if you were to say that in the street, they'd probably think you were talking about Star Wars or something, because, you know, they have the Falcon 9 and the Millennium, and meanwhile, I wasn't even a Star Wars fan. Not much on science fiction. Science documentaries, very good. That's another thing. They have a lot of science documentaries that I've watched over the years. Nova does a great job. You know that. You've seen a lot of them. And recorded a lot of them. Still have them on tape. Some of them are now on disc. And interesting enough, with the what we do here, you know, what is this Space Net number 219? It's, you know, since they've been recording, Mike has been recording this. The earliest one I could find of a Space Net, let me drop it, is 2006. I think it was September. August of September 2006. So that's 10 years of recorded stuff, and I was on before that. And but you know, you've got us talking about things that were going on before. You know, the space station wasn't even completed yet in 2006, and everything that was going on with the constellation. Constellation missions, it was all canceled, you know. But we talked about that. So it goes way back. And before that, I was involved with Limar, Lockfield, before Limar. And I did a space net over there for a little while, but that didn't work out too good. I think it did a bit. That lasted about a year. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
So your records lead you to believe that the first space report on the Landmark TechNet was September 2000. 2006. That's just about exactly 6 years ago. And you had 219 space reports, 52 weeks per year. That sounds like 4 years worth. But yet you started 6 years ago. So in the beginning, Paul, refresh my memory. Did you not have a space report every single week? Was there something like every other week on this TechNet in the beginning? WS2N, K2RIW?
And Mike called it the space report. If you look it up, he wrote space report. So, yeah, that was, no, not 6 years, 10 years. It was 2006. Now we're into 16. So that's 10 years of recorded. That's a lot of recordings. So 10 years. So if we have 219 now, it's like almost 4 years. So I don't know. I guess you could call this TechNet number 500 and something. Maybe, I don't know. And yeah, before that, I was just on. We would talk, and you would bring up a space topic, and then I would add to it because I probably just read something about it or watched it on TV. And next thing you know, here we are. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, a space report every week, 52 weeks per year, 10 years would be 520 of them. And this particular report you're giving us now, you call it 219. Did you really start off with number one? Yes, in the beginning, we didn't number them. Did you just guess at a number, Paul, and maybe you were a little bit too conservative? Or were they doing only numbered every other week? What's your guess as to how 10 years worth of space nets, 500 and some odd of them, only added up as 219? Give me a guess on that one, Paul. What kind of research is required for this one? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, well, that started. What happened was you were saying we'll go to the SpaceNet report. When you started doing that on a regular basis, then I started counting, and it was easy to do back then because I just wrote everything on index cards and, just an outline, covered three or four topics, whatever it was, sometimes one topic. And that would be, I got up to probably around 20 or 30. And then when I hit 60 years old, my daughter got the bright idea to give me a tablet. And that was it. I started recording the nets, well, not recording, but, outlining the nets on the tablets. And I think when you were over here, I think it was up to number 70-something or some number like that, and when I showed you the tablet. And now since then, I've got this Chromebook. What's good about the Chromebook is, as far as saving data, since I got this, I could save all these nets. So I went back in time, I went back. I didn't have the first 20 or 30, but somewhere around 40, I started saving them, putting them into the computer. And the Chromebook saves everything to the cloud, so we now have everything on the cloud, all the tech, not the TechNet, but the space portion of the TechNet on the cloud forever, so once the cloud goes away, I don't even have anything saved on the computer. If the cloud goes away, that's it. I lost all my nets. Back to you there.
What you saved, Paul, is it a spreadsheet of what was discussed during what period of time, or have you saved really the live audio? I'm going to guess it's probably the live audio of all the space reports, that's what you have saved. Is that true, Paul? K2RIW?
No, that's Mike's thing with the audio. He's got them all. No, all I do is have the outline, during the week, if I see, the new blend was introduced in the beginning of the week, so I'll put that into either the tablet or the Chromebook. It doesn't matter. They're like linked together. related to it. And then, for instance, if you bring up a topic, say you bring up the Bigelow topic, how's Bigelow doing? You know, he's the guy who put that inflatable module on the International Space Station, you know, recently. And I could put in Bigelow into search, you know, it'll come up, you know, but whatever nets that we had that we talked about Bigelow will pop up, and you know, I could review them, and then you know, look for some deep details that I forgot. We could always talk about it next week. Back to you, Dick.
One of the last subjects I'd like to discuss is how busy is that low, medium, and high Earth orbit around planet Earth. There's so darn many thousands of objects that have been launched, and each of those objects has got a final payload. On the way up, it's got a whole bunch of shields that have to be jettisoned, explosive bolts that get exploded, all kinds of individual pieces of junk, so to speak. The total number of objects going around planet Earth, it's got to be a huge number. In order to do a launch nowadays without having one of those things hit you, doesn't sound easy. And some of the things are going around the planet in the wrong direction. The things being launched to the west by Israel are, in theory, on a collision course with the things that are going to the east, 17,000 miles to the west, 17,000. We're talking about 35, 36,000 miles closing velocity between these things. I've seen websites where they show you a dot, a yellow dot, to each object that's in orbit, and you see there's a picture of the Earth with all of these dots, and in some of those websites, all of those dots are moving. So the total number of pieces of stuff bigger than a quarter 20 bolt, a nut, that we've got in space, boy, it must be huge. How in the world can NORAD keep track of all of that? How do you do a launch without something hitting you? Got a rough guess as to the total number of objects in space. Of course, the biggest variable is, what do you call an object? Is it a quarter of an inch, a foot? How big is the object that you're keeping track of? So there must be a great big curve of object size versus the number of objects. Over to you, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, at the planetarium, Vanderbilt planetarium I went to about 3 years ago, I think they said 10,000 objects bigger than 10 centimeters. What is that? About 4 inches. I think it was something like 10,000. And then probably, you know, 100,000 things small, you know, nuts and bolts and things that are smaller than that. You know, you've probably seen the picture of Earth with, you know, this swarm of stuff going around it. And then you've had crashes, you know, had Iridium 33 crash into a Russian satellite, a Cosmos satellite. So that, you know, one was going pretty much almost like a polar orbit, and the other one was going, you know, east-west, west-east, and that probably added, you know, another couple of thousand pieces. China shot a rocket up and blew one of their satellites out of the sky. That created a tremendous amount of debris. So I wouldn't be surprised if you told me 100,000 things that are up there. Meanwhile, there's only about 1,000 active satellites, you know, between low Earth orbit and geosynchronous orbit, only about 1,000 that are actually, you know, communicating, doing business. The rest of it's all space junk. They got to clean it up somehow.
In the very beginning, NASA just launched satellites, didn't worry about where the explosive bolts went, where the individual shields went, and so on. I'd like to believe a modern launch has to go through some kind of a approval procedure as to how you're capturing as many of the things as you can to limit the number of objects in space. Is that roughly true, Paul? This has got to be our last question. Over to you, KQRIW.
Yeah, it was called the Big Sky Theory. No, it's so big that we'll never have a problem. Never. So, yeah, that's the way they used to think. Of course, that's all changed. And they have everything computerized, so they know the open spaces. They know what part of the big sky is left for the space station and for all these other objects that are going to be up there not too far in the future, and the time has ticked by. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N, SpaceNet Report. I guess next week we'll do 220.
Looking forward to it, Paul. Okay, this is the bewitching hour. Confused about time, 1,619 technets, 2019 space reports. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And keep learning about electronics, RF, space, hardware, whatever. Tie the ribbons on, is that, Paul? Thank you. WS2N for a final. Keep your eyes over, you clear but listening.
Okay, real good. And John, if you're listening out there, yeah, well, we'll hold down the fort for you. 73, have a good night, Dick. WS2N clear.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQ. Tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.